A 2008 University of Maine study found that 55% of students who joined student groups are hazed. We remember the drum major in Florida A&M's marching band who was beaten to death during a hazing. Yesterday, we heard from a Dartmouth student who says after he blew the whistle on fraternity hazing, he was shunned. Well, today we want to take a look at a school that says it's making changes. Last year, a 19-year-old fraternity brother died in a pledging incident at Cornell. George Dadoon was allegedly tied up and forced to drink. Cornell shut down his fraternity, SAE. Four students are facing charges, and this past summer, Cornell president David Scorton pledged to end pledging as we know it by next spring. The school says it's already instituted new rules banning freshmen from attending fraternity parties where there's alcohol. It says alcohol use is down, but how do you change a culture that leads to hazing? Travis Apgar is Associate Dean of Students at Cornell. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
I guess, you know, we got a lot of outrage response after we spoke about hazing yesterday. A lot of people wanting to know, why is it taking someone dying? The culture of hazing has long been known. Why is it taking Cornell so long?
Well, I think it's not just Cornell. I think if you look at this issue across campuses, you cited the 2008 study from University of Maine. We have a long history, a long list of tragedies, deaths, injuries, yet we still haven't been able to completely resolve the issue.
Well, what are you planning on doing? What are some of the things you're thinking of?
We have a group that's been working together since the fall. They've called themselves the RARE Committee, the idea that this is really a rare opportunity where from the president on down at this university, we have support to really make significant change. It's heavily weighted with students and alumni because those are the folks who really have to buy in, and they really are putting together a set of recommendations that would end pledging as we know it.
What are some of the ideas being batted about?
I think that we know that we need to provide them with more resources for the kinds of activities that we would all agree are healthy and would help them accomplish their goals. You know, people don't realize that the hazing is often performed because the organization really has a legitimate goal in mind. You know, whether it's building team, whether it's creating unity, bonding, you know, that sort of thing. And so we know that there are healthier opportunities for them. Engaging with, for instance, our Cornell Outdoor Education Department, using things like our Challenge course or our Ropes course.
Kind of like an Outward Bound.
Absolutely.
Well, full disclosure, I should say that I'm familiar with the SAE frat house that you closed. And this is from years ago, but some of the nicest people you'd ever meet. New York Times reporter Michael Weinrip writes that his son was happily in an SAE chapter without any problems. But as we've been saying, something obviously went very wrong. We have some questions from our listeners. They want to know, what about doing as Williams College did in the 60s and abolish fraternities? It's painful at first, but in the long run made campus life better.
Well, and I think that every campus has to establish what works best for their campus. You know, Cornell's Greek community has been a part of the fabric of this institution since the beginning. We have an opportunity here at Cornell to find a way to make significant changes that truly define the next evolution of what fraternity and sorority is to be.
The story of the brother who died at Cornell is made, even if it can be made sadder, it is made sadder by the fact that he was the son of a single mom from Haiti who cleaned bathrooms so that her son could go to this school. How much did this reverberate, or is this still reverberating on campus?
Speaking as somebody who knew George, attended his funeral, I would say it reverberated and still does today. You know, we're an ever-changing group of students. It's always turning over. However, it's our job to make sure that every new group that comes in recognizes the dangers of things like hazing and these kinds of activities. George's story is just tragic. You know, I've had conversations with people who completely support the direction that we're going and other institutions are going in terms of really trying to end hazing. And I've also come up against people who would tell us that we will not be able to change things and that we're talking about human behavior and therefore, you know, we're somewhat powerless. And I'm always reminded of the feeling I had sitting at George's funeral, insisting in my own mind that we absolutely have to find ways to make this change, because there is no way that I as a professional could continue in my profession feeling that feeling, you know, knowing that that one of our students was lost for a completely unwarranted
stupid
purpose.
That's Travis Apgar, Associate Dean of Students at Cornell. Dean Apgar, Travis, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Okay, let's bring in Tim Marshall, a psychologist, director of mental health initiatives at Cornell. He's working on the school's anti-hazing initiatives. Tim, pledging is secretive, but what happens during hazing has been well publicized, so help us understand. Why do students agree to go through it?
Well, even though generally people may be aware that hazing occurs on a particular campus or in types of organizations, there's secrecy that shrouds the activities of individual groups, and so people really are not giving informed consent. They don't know exactly what they're going to be going through. So there's a very strong coercive element to the whole process of hazing. There's also often alcohol involved, which can impair people's judgment and ability to resist. Students often fear the negative consequences that would happen if, once they're being hazed, they try to resist or try to walk away. We've had situations where people have been hazed more severely when they tried to resist. Hazers often use threats to people's sense of themselves as young men or women, so they question whether or not they're tough enough, things like this. Are you a real man? But I think the most powerful factor in all this is the fear of social rejection. In some ways, our brains react to rejection by peers like they do to a threat of to our physical health or even the food supply. So at a neural level, putting up with hazing may feel necessary for survival.
Well, and that brings us to things we've read and heard, that sometimes people put into these hazing situations are put back into childhood situations, for instance. If there's some sort of even low-level violence in the home, you're suddenly put back into that kind of, gee, I better do what I'm told, fetal position.
One of the things that people misunderstand about hazing is that you can't determine how severe a particular hazing experience is just by looking at it, because the actual severity of the consequences has to do with a combination of what the people are going through and their inner experiences. What's their past history? What's their emotional state? What's their personality? What are their values? So you could have 10 people going through the exact same experience. Some of them may seem to brush it off easily. Others may be traumatized. If someone has been abused in the past, that can bring up all of those emotions. We've had people, including men who have been sexually abused in the past, when they were forced to go through something that involved nudity, were re-traumatized through that experience.
Yeah, that's the landmine, right? You don't know who that person's going to be that might react well. You don't know who the person's going to be who doesn't have any tolerance for alcohol.
Well, they may not have a tolerance for alcohol, or they may be like 1 out of 10 college students nationwide who have seriously considered suicide in the past year. Many students are struggling with underlying emotional difficulties. And when you require, for example, someone like that to stay up all night and endure sleep deprivation, or you put them through humiliation or intimidation, that can be very damaging to their emotional health. Someone who has an alcohol problem, similarly, you can exacerbate that problem as well.
And you just don't know where those landmines are. That's Tim Marshall, director of mental health initiatives at Cornell University, helping us look at hazing. We've been doing it for the past 2 days. Tons of comments at our website from listeners. Bill R. says, I don't think fraternities should be in universities. I pledged at an ATO fraternity 10, 20 years ago. It was miserable, constantly harassed, eventually urinated on by the older brothers. You know, we apologize for some of this language. We're going to hear more when we come back, because we want to know what's in the mind of the hazers, the people doing the hazing. That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Tim Marshall, director of mental health initiatives at Cornell, which says it's going to come up with alternatives to the pledging that leads to hazing. And Tim, we were talking about how hazing affects different people in different ways, the forced drinking, eating a vomit omelet. You know, this is stuff that people would find objectionable if it were done to detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Can you tell a little more about what happens when someone is, you know, sleep deprived or drinking so much so that they think, this is what I deserve?
Let me give you an example of what a student described to me. She was in a situation where she was standing up in front of the other group members who were grilling her about information about the group for a quiz she had to pass. When she started talking about this, she began crying. And when I asked her what that was like to go through that, she said, "It was hard enough and humiliating and intimidating enough, but the hardest thing was I was so terrified of what might happen next. What might these people do? If they're treating me this way in this situation, what will happen if I say no and I try to walk away?" So the fear of what can happen, what can go wrong, is very intensive and can lead people to go along and comply with what's being asked of them, even though they completely object to it.
Now, you tell a story of someone who was resisting being paddled but had that same thought. And this is something compassionate that came out in this person, but he thought that if he walked away, the other pledges would suffer.
We have found situations, and this was an example, where a student described to me being paddled, and he refused to allow the brothers to paddle him anymore. And they said, "If you don't allow us to do it, we're going to paddle your pledge brothers even harder." And when he kept firm and resisted, in fact, the other pledges were hit harder, so he then acquiesced. And, you know, you can see the group dynamic is that you're really not free to walk away. It's not just like you can say, "I've had enough, I'm going to walk out the door." In that situation, there were serious consequences. And in many of these types of situations, even if nothing worse would happen, there is a fear that it would. And there's this fear is instilled by the whole process.
Why do people do the hazing? Is it just people who are cruel? I mean, how is it that, as we heard from a Dartmouth student yesterday, you know, people who would no more think of torturing someone or tying them up or lying to them and you know, being brutal to them are able to do it? And I guess the second part of that question is one of the dangers of pledging that you might have some people who enjoy doing the hazing more than others?
Well, this is really not about a few bad apples. There is always some individuals with antisocial tendencies who may enjoy the hazing. But for the most part, people's behavior is shaped by the circumstances that they're in. There are situational and cultural factors that lead good people to do bad things. In general, groups don't invent hazing. They inherit it. So it's very important to look at this from a systemic cultural perspective and try to understand what's the mentality of the people that have been through this who feel like, well, we went through it, everyone before us went through it, so we're going to make the next group go through it. And when we pause and have conversations with these students and challenge them on that, many times they'll step back and say, "Really, what are we thinking of?" One person said to me, who was in a fraternity that had been caught hazing, he looked at his brothers and said, "You know, the people that I'm closest to, my family, they never humiliated or intimidated me. So if we're supposed to be brothers, why did we do those things to the pledges?" And those are the kind of conversations we need to have.
And it sounds like you've had at least one. So is that, you know, what's encouraging here? Because, frankly, it doesn't sound as if, you know, there are that many other ideas for how to change the system that we're hearing colleges want to change. It doesn't sound like it can be imposed. You might even drive some of the hazing underground. But what I hear you're saying is that if somebody can have that light bulb go off, that may be the beginning of change.
Education is necessary, but it's not sufficient. And it's not just for students. The entire campus needs to understand what hazing is. The alumni need to know, parents need to know, and they need to know the harm that hazing can cause. We also need to correct misperceptions that people have about tolerance for hazing. What I find when I work with groups, including fraternities, is that in some situations, most of them oppose the hazing, but they think everyone else supports it. And so when we create a situation where we can expose those misperceived norms, people are more free to act in different ways. And that also requires the alumni stepping forward and saying, "You know something? We did it, but it was wrong, and we want you to stop that." So there's a number of steps that are required to overcome secrecy. There needs to be consequences that are swift, that are certain, and that are sufficient. And one of the most important things is that we need to provide young people with opportunities for non-hazing, team-building, group-building activities that meet their legitimate underlying goals of bonding and cohesion.
And this is kind of the outward bound angle that we were just hearing from Dean Apgar?
That's one of the approaches that you can take to this. But in many situations, what's required is not necessarily some type of intensive activity, although that can help support this process, but really just spending time and service together as a group. Doing community service is one of the things that we found that some groups have found has been the most important factor in bringing them together.
Boy, do you think you have your work cut out for you, you know, replacing Pong and sixes, you know, at Dartmouth they do six beers in 30 seconds with, you know, picking up trash or doing community service. I mean, isn't that a challenge?
It is no small task. This is a major challenge. But when I have conversations with individual student leaders, and in some cases entire groups, and I hear them begin to recognize the discrepancy between their stated values, their personal beliefs, and what they find themselves doing. And when they talk about the idea of being able to make change, if someone would help them figure out how to do it, that gives me some hope that we can really make headway.
Tim Marshall, head of Cornell University's Mental Health Services. He also works on that school's anti-hazing initiatives, while the school also has a panel trying to come up with a way to end pledging as we know it by at least next spring. Tim, Dr. Marshall, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
So it's not just Cornell. Binghamton University of New York halted all pledging this spring. They called for a review after incidents. Your thoughts on alternatives to pledging? Would a rope climb replace Pong, the drinking game? Let us know your thoughts here at now.org. Still ahead today, ceasefire. What ceasefire? The BBC's Owen Bennett Jones on Syria. The latest news is next, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu. And by the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston with Figuring Color, exploring the expressive power of color in paintings and sculpture, ICABoston.org.